I'm Executive Vice President for NEA BPD, and I'm going to be this evening's moderator. We are, however, blessed that Dr. Perry Hoffman made a safe trip down from Boston, and she will be able to join us this evening. Well, we're really fortunate, again, to have with us Dr. Blaise Aguirre and Jillian Galen, both of whom are from Harbors McLean Hospital in Belmont, Mass. And it turns out that tonight is the third and the final evening of their series, which they've entitled Making Sense of Mindfulness, Understanding How to Practice Mindfulness in Daily Living. Well, to make everyone's listening experience as good as possible, your lines have been muted. And that said, we would like to have your feedback and your questions, which if time is remaining, will be answered. So you can email us now or during the presentation at neabpd@aol.com. Tonight's call is being recorded, and as with all the previous call-ins, you can revisit the evening at our website at borderlinepersonalitydisorder.com. We have made it a little bit easier for you to get to these call-in recordings. I think if you just go to the home page and on the right-hand column, you can click on that and pull up previous call-ins. So just remember, please, that your donations to NEA BPD help us to help you, and we are an all-volunteer organization, and we sincerely thank Drs. Jillian I'll get your name straight. Yeah, Dr. Galen and Dr. Aguirre for donating their time this evening and their wisdom. So now we have Dr. Galen and Aguirre. It's yours.
Thank you. So we're back for our last part of this four-part series, and we've gone over practicing mindfulness, focusing on what you do and how you do it, and using the skills of DBT to help break down this practice and give you some sort of easy day-to-day ways to practice mindfulness in your life. And actually, today we're going to stray a little bit from the formal DBT practices of mindfulness, and we're going to look at two particular practices that both Blaise and I feel have a particular application to BPD. And they're not specifically mentioned in DBT. So the two practices that we're going to focus on this evening are going to be the loving-kindness practice, which is also called the metta practice, as well as the practice of gratitude. So we're going to look a little bit more in-depth into these practices, look at a little bit of the research, and even some of the maybe imaging studies on these practices of mindfulness. And we'll also begin, as we have the last few of our calls, with a two-minute practice, and Blaise is going to begin and describe that practice and discuss metta.
So good evening, everybody. And so here's the practice that we want you to do for the next 2 minutes. If you have someone in your life who's struggling with BPD, we want you to hold that person in your mind. So just keep that person in the forefront of your mind. If you yourself have BPD, hold someone that you love in your mind. Okay, so here's what you're going to do. What you're going to do is, whether it's the person in your life with BPD or the person that you love, if you have BPD, what we want you to do is just the thought that you want wellness for that person, that you want them to have freedom from any suffering in their lives. So what's going to happen is you're going to say, I think of this person, and I think of freedom from suffering from them, that you don't want them to suffer. And then what will happen is that as you do this for the next 2 minutes, because our minds do this, other thoughts will come into your mind. And what we want you to do is just let go of those thoughts and return to the thought of wishing your loved one freedom from suffering. So for the next 2 minutes, and you hear the bell, the mindfulness bell, just hold somebody near and dear to you in your mind and wish them freedom from suffering. So, Jillian, if you'll ring the bell. Okay, so just observe what happened when you practiced this practice. How did you feel afterwards towards the person? Did it change? Did it make you happier, not happier, angrier? What did it do? Did it change anything? So, as many people on this call know, living with borderline personality disorder can be an intolerable mix of pain, sadness, emptiness, loneliness, and self-loathing. For many people who live with this disorder, it is this mystery that often and it's a misery that's unresponsive to any medication, which leads a person to say enough. And it is true that the loved ones of people with BPD can experience just as much hopelessness as those with BPD when they see their loved ones suffering. But in order to get to joy, or at least to less suffering, it is important to practice suffering less. So the idea is that the more you practice suffering, and you don't think of it as practice suffering, but it's what you're doing in your mind is you're telling yourself these suffering stories over and over again. You've got to practice less suffering. The way to do this is through practices that we just mentioned, and we'll get into them in more detail, loving kindness and gratitude. Remember that the more you practice any behavior or action, the better you get at it. So the more you practice loving kindness, the more you practice gratitude, the better you're going to get at that. So here's some of the evidence. So Richard Davidson, who is the director of Laboratory of Affective Neuroscience in Wisconsin, has scanned the brains of Buddhist monks as they practice loving kindness. And they found that during the practice, the areas of the brain, which is actually the left prefrontal cortex, and other areas of the brain that are associated with joy became very, very active. So here are these monks. Their brains were pretty calm. They started practicing loving kindness, and the areas of the brain that experienced joy lit up. And then the other thing was that the areas of the brain that were associated with suffering became far less active. But most of us on this call, myself and Jillian included, are not highly trained and compassionate monks. So what about the rest of us? What about or people who just suffer from BPD? So what Davidson then did is he took 41 ordinary people, not monks, and they were actually stressed out volunteers at a local biotechnology firm. And they all went EEG testing at the beginning of the research. They did an EEG scan. And then the 41 were divided into two groups, 25 who practiced meditation and 16 who did not. The meditation group took an 8-week course in mindfulness meditation, and both the meditators and the non-meditators were then again tested by EEG. And to make things even more interesting, what they did is they gave everybody influenza vaccine, and then they had blood tests to check for antibodies. 4 months later, they all had EEG tests again, and the 25 meditators' brains showed a marked shift in activity towards the part of the brain where joy is experienced. So you didn't have to be a trained monk to begin to have activation in the parts of the brain that experience joy. And the 16 that didn't have that didn't practice mindfulness meditation, they showed no shift at all. So their brains were essentially unchanged. And what was also interesting is that the people who did mindfulness meditation had much more immune responses to the influenza shot. So mindfulness was helping not only in experiencing joy, but also an improved immune response. Okay, but that's just mindfulness meditation. What about loving compassion? In a 2008 study with Davidson, they compared 16 Buddhist meditators to 16 non-meditators and looked at what happened to their brain during the practice of loving kindness. The researchers, what they found is that the ability to generate loving kindness stimulated activation of brain pathways linked to empathy and the capacity to understand that other people have desires, emotions, beliefs, and intentions different from ours. And one of the things that we've mentioned in other calls has been this idea of mentalizing, and there's a whole treatment around mentalizing, MBT, mentalization-based psychotherapy. And this idea that practicing loving kindness can get you to think not only about your own brain, but about the minds and emotions and beliefs of others is very, very powerful. It's one of the things that is thought to be lacking in borderline personality disorder. Okay, so let's get on to the practice of loving kindness meditation. And as Gillian mentioned, it's also known as metta. So loving kindness is a meditation practice to develop the mental habit of selfless or altruistic love. And here, as we know, we're not getting into a religious form of loving-kindness meditation. We practice secular meditation. But one nice quote in Buddhism is that hatred cannot coexist with loving-kindness and dissipates if supplanted with thoughts based on loving-kindness. So if you think about you have a brain that is full of rage and full of anger, that by practicing love and kindness, that some of that will begin to infiltrate the hatred and the anger, and it will begin to dissipate the hatred and the anger. Loving kindness meditation seeks to produce four qualities of love: friendliness, compassion, appreciation, and mental calmness. Now, what a wonderful thing for any of us to have, whether we have BPD or not. The quality of friendliness is expressed as warmth that reaches out and embraces others. When loving-kindness practice matures, it naturally overflows into compassion, and you begin to empathize with others' difficulties without feeling pity for the other. And pity is concern without empathy. So we don't want to pity people with BPD, and people with BPD don't want to be pitied, but to be loved compassionately. The positive expression of empathy is an appreciation of other people's good qualities or good fortune, appreciative joy rather than feelings of jealousy towards them, so that when good things happen, that there isn't this anger, there isn't this resentment, but just a true joy that good things are happening to other people. This series of meditations comes to maturity as you develop mental calmness and evenness. And people sometimes think that people who meditate a lot are very aloof and disconnected, but it's not indifference or aloofness. Instead, it's a disposition for caring towards everybody and the spread of loving feelings and acceptance. So how to do it? Now, this is very hard for many people with BPD, and yet it is the path to get you there. So the practice begins with developing a loving acceptance of yourself. If you notice resistance towards practicing loving acceptance to yourself, it is often because you don't feel worthy of your own love. And this exactly underscores the work that you need to do. You have to start targeting self-loathing, targeting self-doubt, and other negative self-thoughts. Loving kindness for yourself will develop loving kindness for others, and this in turn will develop loving kindness for yourself. So it's a circular thing. You develop loving kindness for yourself, that you develop loving kindness for others, and then when you develop loving kindness, your brain is beginning to practice love. And then that love will turn to yourself and to other people. One of my favorite quotes from the Dalai Lama is, if you want others to be happy, practice compassion. If you want to be happy, practice compassion. Okay. So let's get now to the more formal practice of how it is done. And let me just say that there's a lot of different ways in which loving kindness, loving compassion is practice. So this is just one way. And this may be difficult for some people, but what the loving practice thought is that there's four kinds of people, and these are the people to hold in your mind. A respected person, such as a spiritual teacher or a beloved teacher. A dearly beloved person, such as a close family member or friend. A neutral person, somebody who you know but you don't have any special feelings towards, like, you know, maybe your local post person or somebody at the grocery store that you know, or a neighbor that you might just know who isn't too close. And then a hostile person, someone with whom you're currently having a difficulty with. Now, we're going to use a practice developed by Sharon Salzberg, who is a leading figure in the field of loving compassion or metta meditation. There are many, again, as I said, there are many, many ways to practice this. But here's a simple way. So what you do is you start, and as with all mindfulness practices, find a quiet place where you can sit and be grounded with feet firmly planted on the ground, your palms on your lap, turned upwards, breathing straight back. And what the mindfulness practice is, you start off by saying, may I be safe from danger. Then may I be happy. Then may I be healthy and strong. Then may I have ease of well-being. So what you do is that you repeat that. You repeat that for a couple of minutes. 1, 2, 3 minutes, whatever you can do. May I be safe from danger. May I be happy. May I be healthy and strong. May I have ease of well-being. Now, this isn't something that is said out loud. It is said in your mind. Then once you've got yourself in mind and wishing all those things for you, then you next move on to the respected person, the spiritual teacher, a beloved teacher in school, someone who has been a guiding light for you. And then you say, may that person be safe from danger. May they be happy. May they be healthy and strong. May they have ease of well-being. And you do that, and you do that for the same amount of time as you've done it for yourself. And then you move to the dearly beloved person, a family member, a spouse, a child, a lover, anybody who you consider a close friend, and you repeat it. And then the same thing for the neutral person, and here's the thing. Then you do it for the hostile person. And this is where many, many, many people get tripped up because they cannot imagine forgiving somebody who's hurt them. They cannot imagine being kind to someone who's hurting them. The recipient is never going to know that you're practicing loving kindness towards them. You're training your brain to practice compassion and loving kindness. The one thing that you have to be a little bit careful about, and that is that occasionally when you think about the loving person, it can be that lust creeps into your mind because you might have sexual desire for them and that sort of thing. And not to confuse sex or sexual desire from loving kindness or just a freedom from suffering for that other person. So if it's if that seems to get you into trouble, then practice who your beloved person is. Maybe make someone of the same sex as you whatever is not going to arouse lust in you. Now, remember that everybody, even people that you are in conflict with, they themselves don't want to suffer. And hold them in your mind when you're practicing this. Now, there are certain ways of arousing feelings of loving kindness. Again, you have to find your way of practicing this. So visualization, which is you can close your eyes, you can bring up a mental picture, you can see yourself or the other person the feeling is directed to, and what you can imagine is you can imagine smiling at them, and you can imagine or visualize them smiling back at you. Some people have a very easy time visualizing. Other people, and Dr. Marsha Linehan has said that she has a very difficult time visualizing. So, again, you do the practice that works for you. Then you can do it by reflection. Reflect on the positive qualities of a person and the acts of kindness they have done. And then to yourself, making a positive statement about yourself. And then auditory, and this is probably the simplest form, but it's probably also the most effective. So what you might do is that when you're in conflict with somebody, maybe say the word loving kindness or freedom from suffering out loud to yourself or under your breath as you approach them, just to keep in mind a little prompt for what you've been practicing. Ultimately, when you've practiced this for a long time and are able to generate loving kindness feelings, imagine a bubble of kindness around you. And then it's like one of those bubbles that, you know, kids blow and they get bigger and bigger and bigger. And that there's this bubble of kindness, and then slowly it's expanding around the world, and it's allowing different people to come into the bubble of kindness that you have, including people ultimately that you don't like very much. The point is that you're training your brain in kindness rather than hatred, or all the negative self-talk that you've been practicing. So although loving kindness meditation often starts as a sitting practice, it should not be seen just as a sitting practice and removed from everyday life. So when you do, when you practice loving kindness enough, take it to the streets, take it to your work, take it to your home, take it to dinner parties, take that loving kindness, let it radiate it, let people see your compassion and your kindness towards others. So, okay, so what about enemies again? Being compassionate towards enemies or people you don't like is a difficult practice. Being compassionate does not mean that you're going to allow the other person to hurt you again or cause you suffering. Compassion means changing your motivation from hatred to compassion. So what you're doing is that you're saying, my motivation to change what's going on is not hatred, because that can lead you to certain set of actions, but it is compassion. Now, you might still do those actions, but you're doing so out of compassion rather than hatred. And why? In the long run, it is because hatred breeds hatred, and wishing the perpetrator of your suffering their own freedom may not help them in the long run, but you yourself will be happier, because what you're doing is that you're practicing happiness. So that is the practice of loving kindness meditation. And what I'm going to do is Jillian's now going to take over, and she's going to talk a little bit about gratitude. And we've left it so that it's not going to be a full hour, because I think that there were a lot of questions that came up in the last couple of weeks, and we hoped to have a little bit more time so that people could ask questions. So with that, I'll turn it over to Jillian.
Thanks, Blaise. Just to underscore the metta practice, I'm a big fan of it. I think it's an incredible way to change your own experience. So I would really encourage people to start today or tomorrow and really try out this metta practice and pay attention to your own experience. So I think a lot of people can get caught up in the idea of that other people are going to win out maybe on being compassionate if you're maybe angry at that person. But remember that actually the practice of metta is about your own experience first. So really paying attention to how you can feel different, and then as a result how you interact with the world differently. Last week there were some questions on books, so if you're actually interested in more detailed accounts of metta, or more specific, there's many, many different ways to practice. A great book is Loving Kindness, all one word. It's called The Revolutionary Art of Happiness by Sharon Salzberg. Actually, any of her books are excellent, but this is a really nice introduction to her practice. Supposed to remind everyone that there's going to be a list of a couple books that we would recommend around mindfulness that will be posted on the NEA BPD website. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the second practice, which is gratitude. And like we started with metta, I'm going to give you a little bit of some research that they've looked at how gratitude actually heightens quality of life. So there were a number of researchers who conducted the following experiment on gratitude and looked at the impact on general well-being. So here's what they did. So they split several hundred people into three different groups. All of the participants were asked to keep a daily diary. So group one kept a diary of events that occurred during the day, and they weren't given any direction about what to write, whether it was good or bad things, but they just left an account of their day. So the second group was told to record their unpleasant experiences in that diary. And the last group was instructed to make a daily list of things for which they were grateful. And the results of the study were quite interesting. So the results of the study indicated that the daily gratitude exercise, so simply writing in the journal things that they were grateful for, resulted in higher reported levels of alertness, higher enthusiasm, greater determination, optimism, and energy. In addition, those in the gratitude group reported experiencing less depression and stress and were more likely to help others, to exercise more regularly, and made greater progress towards achieving personal goals. So, you know, just from that study, you can see how the practice of gratitude, even the simple practice of keeping a journal, can actually have a pretty profound impact on our lives. So one of the wonderful things about gratitude is that you can actually quiet the mind and get moments of peace as you practice gratitude. So while gratitude may not necessarily solve a problem, it can be a wonderful way to shift and relax your mind so that you can look at sort of what is in front of you. So for many people with BPD, and even their family and friends, life can often seem unfair, and it often can feel like there's actually little to be grateful for. And for some people, the practice of gratitude can come very easily, and for other people, they actually need to look for gratitude. So it is much more of a skill that's practiced with awareness. And if you are one of those people, I would encourage you to remember to not judge your level of gratitude, to not use it as something that you compare to somebody else, but as a practice that you do for yourself. So here are some different ways to do this practice and to get some of the benefits for practicing gratitude. So this would be a practice that you could guide yourself through. So, like many of our other practices that we would that we've reviewed, we ask you to sit in a mindful position, relaxing your shoulders, relaxing your arms and your back, palms up for many, feeling grounded, either sitting cross-legged or maybe sitting in a chair with your feet on the ground, uncrossing legs, feeling open, and begin to take a few mindful breaths. So for many people, it can be very helpful to just scan your body and notice areas of tension. And then one thing you can do is when you notice an area that is tense, you can actually deliberately tense up that area, hold it for a moment, and then release it. So allowing the tension to melt away in your body and helping you relax, and then focusing your attention on gratitude. So you'd continue to take mindful breaths. And for many in the practice of gratitude, which is can be a new practice, it's very, very easy for the mind to wander. So when your mind wanders, you can bring your attention back to your breath. You can also bring your attention back to your body. So the first step around gratitude is practicing gratitude for your surroundings. So you could begin by practicing gratitude for being here right now, for perhaps being in the room that you're in, for being able to have an opportunity to practice mindfulness, for all of us to be able to practice mindfulness together. You can be thankful or feel gratitude perhaps for the chair that you're in, for the clothes on your body, the shoes on your feet, perhaps for the dinner that you have had, for the food in your refrigerator, for the weather that was outside today, for the moment that you took to look up at the sky, to notice the clouds, to be grateful for what you have right in this moment. So the next step in a gratitude practice would be to practice gratitude and cultivate gratitude for the people in your life. So it may be that you are grateful or thankful for an opportunity to talk to somebody that you ran into throughout the day, perhaps grateful for somebody that said hello or smiled as they walked by, for somebody that perhaps asks you how you're doing, or for people in your life that are taking care of you, or perhaps for your ability to care for somebody else, or for people that help you on a regular basis. So actually practicing looking for the people that you come across in your life. Now, they may be people close to you, or they may be people that you have no clear relationship with, but to actually expanding your mind and taking time to notice these people. And then the next practice, which can be for many challenging in the way that metta is to cultivate gratitude for yourself. So it may be expressing gratitude for your ability simply to be present, for a simple mindful moment where you notice something that brought you joy. It could be to have gratitude for a moment of kindness, for the ability to practice kindness towards yourself, even if it is a completely new experience and it only lasts a very short time. But to be actually paying attention to what you are grateful for within yourself and things that you're grateful for because you have done them. So paying attention to what you want to do is really, as you practice this, you want to pay attention to what gratitude feels like in your body. So notice as you sort of take in things that you are grateful for, what does it feel like? So what's the quality of your thoughts? Do you notice that you are maybe more tense or more relaxed? But really start to pay attention. As you practice this, you want to pay attention to how you experience it. So what does it feel like? And is it something that shifts the way that you think or the way that you feel? So another really important practice around gratitude is to think about the things that you take for granted. So most of us, many of us, take things for granted mostly because we're not aware of them. So many of the things that we actually take for granted, we do that because we aren't paying attention to them. So we haven't, you know, they've become our habits or things that we are just sort of used to having. So there's a nice way to start to bring your awareness and expand your awareness out to the things in your life that we take for granted. So this would be an exercise that you could do. So imagine losing some of the things that you take for granted. So that might be things that are important to you in your daily life. It could be, you know, your car, could be clothing, could be your ability to stop for a cup of coffee. And it could be something like one of your senses, so your ability to hear or walk. Or thinking about any of those things that give you comfort that you don't generally pay attention to. So now that you have those in your mind, imagine what it would be like to lose them. So pay attention to what that would feel like in your body. So pick one of those things and just notice what it would feel like if it wasn't there. So next what you'll do is you'll imagine getting that thing back. So you may have imagined many things. So you'll sit and you'll breathe and you'll imagine getting each one of those things back. So one by one, as you let them enter back into your mind and into your life, consider how grateful you are for each one of those things. And then again, notice what it feels like. So some of the most interesting gratitude practices are often for those things in your life that are very small. So they may be those day-to-day things. So often people get caught around gratitude and sort of hold out for those big achievements. So it could be things like marriages, graduations, big life events and life achievements. And so that's a wonderful, wonderful thing to practice gratitude for. But in these practices, we would challenge you to pay attention day to day to the little things in your life that you feel gratitude for and for the things perhaps that you unwittingly and unknowingly had taken for granted. So the final practice of gratitude, which I would really encourage everybody to do, I think this is an incredible practice, is to keep a gratitude journal. So this is a wonderful, quick practice and an excellent way to actually build the gratitude skill by practicing it daily. So what you would do is you would find a journal, does not have to be a fancy journal, And either at the end of the day or in the morning, what you would do is you would write anywhere from maybe 3 to 10 things that you're grateful for. And I would encourage you to write, to really expand your awareness and pay attention to all the different things that you feel gratitude for, and paying attention to your role in observing those things. So, you know, perhaps you are grateful for the weather, and that you can feel that gratitude because you took some time as you walked outside, perhaps to your car, to look up, to pause, and to notice the weather around you and really experience it. So everything in this journal is up to you. So they could be large things and small things. But as you write, breathe, and actually experience each one of these things, experience the gratitude that you have for them. So I can't encourage you guys enough to start with a gratitude journal. You know, another writing exercise that you can do around gratitude is to write a gratitude letter, or perhaps in this day and age, an email or a text, and to send that out to somebody in your life who you are feeling gratitude for. So in this practice, you wouldn't this isn't sort of a thank you, or this wouldn't be in reaction necessarily to something, but it would be just a practice of noticing a sense of gratitude and then communicating it out to someone else. This can be also an excellent task to do when you maybe are feeling annoyed at somebody who is also somebody that you care very deeply about. So those are the practices on gratitude and metta that we wanted to share with you all tonight, so that you now have a bigger toolbox of mindfulness practices and skills to go off with.
So that's it. I think that we've had four hours of mindfulness and mindfulness practice, and we wanted to leave a couple of 15 minutes or so to allow people to ask questions about any of the mindfulness practices that we've been talking about. Again, and especially in BPD, I think it's difficult for everybody to do mindfulness, and they tend to give up quite quickly. It doesn't have to be only for people with BPD, but their family members as well. But for a lot of people with BPD, they do struggle with the mindfulness practice. And most who are able to practice and stick with it find that it is the way out. So with that, are there any emails that have come in or questions?
Yeah, one is curiosity about the sustainability of the once a person leaves therapy, how to maintain a lasting effect. Let's say with the gratitude, if they don't have any requirements to log into a journal, and they don't have somebody reminding them the value, or would you expect that the results would be sufficient that they would just have a strong desire to want to continue in this?
That's a great question. I think for everybody, mindfulness is a practice. It's an incredibly challenging practice, and the tricky thing about mindfulness is it's often the time that we need mindfulness the most, which would be which for many of us are when things are busy or hectic, or when we're in more pain or distress. That tends to be the time that we don't practice it. So I think, mindfulness is really, it's a lifelong practice, and it's also a habit. So, I think starting in therapy with mindfulness, can be an excellent way, and people, in DBT might have it on their diary card. But really what you need to do around mindfulness is make your own commitment, which is challenging. This is challenging, I think, for everybody. This is certainly going to be challenging for people with BPD as well as people that have busy lives. But you really, you only need about 2 minutes, 2 minutes a day. And some days it will be easy and some days it will be harder. And often we will fall off the commitment to mindfulness, and you know, something will trigger us to come back. Now, it might be a therapist. It might be that we start to remember the benefits. You know, when you do practice mindfulness for a long period of time, you could do this through yoga or through any of these practices, it does have a habit of reinforcing itself. So you do start to feel differently. So it is tricky. It's like any habit. That you can absolutely commit to your therapist. You know, there's some wonderful online resources. There's also some really wonderful meditation groups that people have put together. So a great way to stay committed is to practice with a bunch of people. You don't necessarily need an expert. You could have a couple of your friends get together once a week and practice mindfulness together so that everybody stays accountable to one another. But it is a practice, and that is one of the challenges.
I think, you know, it's sort of similar to exercise, and that is a year ago I made a commitment to get up every morning and run with a group of friends, and this year I haven't made that commitment, and I've certainly noticed that my level of fitness has begun to drop off. So again, as with any commitment that you make to yourself, it is some of them are easier, some of them are more difficult. And I agree with Jillian. I mean, some people are very self-driven and they can do it on their own, and others, like I do, I mean, I prefer to jog with a group of friends, and so, you know, maybe doing some mindfulness practice with a group of like-minded people is going to make it easier. And it's absolutely true that if you don't practice, but that's true of any cognitive skill, if you don't practice the work that you do, it's going to be more difficult to do. If you don't practice exercise, it'll be more difficult. If you don't practice mindfulness, if you don't practice typing, whatever it is, it's going to be more difficult. So that's right, persistence. And you have to also pay attention to the benefit in your life.
Exactly. Okay. here's one. Can you review for us a group of mindfulness practice examples to accommodate a variety of situations? I like the M&Ms, but my waist doesn't. Somebody with a sense of humor. In other words, I think I know who this might have come from. That somebody that runs groups and loves to have a lot of examples.
Right. Well, I mean, there are. You know, one of the things that I always say is that anything that you can do mindlessly, you can do mindfully. And so I like to make a distinction between playing games and a mindfulness practice. And you could say take anything. I mean, you could play a game of cards. You could do mindfully or mindlessly. So take things that you would ordinarily do and think about doing that thing mindfully. You could set that up as your practice. Today we are going to clean up the room mindfully, or we're going to sit on our chairs mindfully, or we're going to clean off the table mindfully. And it doesn't have to be certainly around eating. I mean, you know, you can use all your senses. You can, you know, people can bring in their favorite scents. Now, you've got to be a little bit careful because sometimes people get, allergic to perfumes and that sort of thing. But just maybe some light scents, some light creams, or they can do some lotions or, so touch or smell or sound. You know, we can listen mindlessly to music or we can listen mindfully. So anything, take anything that you do and think about putting on your shoes mindfully. You know, so just notice the shoe for the first time. Don't just slip them on. Just think about whatever it is.
There are many low-fat options. I mean, people do raisins. People do. I mean, you can really do anything. You know, pick any kind of food that has, you know, different textures, or that you're curious about. And again, like Blaise said, eat it mindfully.
Okay. Your thoughtfulness and thoroughness in explaining the many facets of mindfulness makes it a challenge to find fresh questions. Thinking of, you remember the dueling banjos? How about each of you testing one another with your most vexing question on mindfulness? That's catching you cold. That's all.
Yeah. Well, here's for me. I think one of the most difficult things about mindfulness, because mindfulness is the act of observing non-judgmentally and experientially the moment as it is and without attachment to it. And I think that it is very difficult at times, as you sort of practice loving kindness to all being things and everybody, and so that you start to break down boundaries between between people and just recognize that people are people, all desiring love. And then, so sometimes the question has come up, and it's come up to me, is then how do you attach? How do you connect with a spouse or something like that? And somebody's asked me the question. I mean, is the Dalai Lama married? Was Jesus married? Was the Buddha married? Is Marcia married? And it turns out that all these people are single. So it's an interesting question about attachment and non-attachment. So I think for me that holding in the balance, that you can attach without attachment and you can let go of attachment, I think would be for me, and I don't know how Jillian would tackle that one. So.
Wow. It was a little tricky because I think Blaise and I have actually had this conversation, and it's something that we both, I think, are quite curious about. Because I think you do have to be careful when you practice non-attachment to not practice an absolute non-attachment to anything. Because then, in that sense, you might be actually narrowing your focus too much. That you might actually not. You know, we talk a lot about effectiveness. I think being too detached would probably not be. I don't think would be effective in the world, you know, that we live in. It would be not being able to balance, you know, attention to your own needs and perhaps attention to the people around you. But I do think it's a wonderful question. It's a wonderful debate that I think we've had. I'm not sure if that answers. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if that answers the question, but it's an excellent question, I think, for people to think about, because I think absolute non-attachment would be detachment, and detachment would not be mindfulness. So it's a fine line. Would be my answer.
I don't know if this ties in. Another one. I'm confused about the role of participating. Is it mainly to lower my own inhibitions and judgments, I guess, about myself and others?
So I can understand where there was a little bit of confusion, because in one way that we discuss the participate skill, I think we gave some examples around anxiety, almost like, you know, exposure, mm-hmm. which is one way to fully participate. But the skill of being able to fully participate would be sort of entering into the present moment, so entering into what is in front of you. And when you do that, in order to be fully present in whatever is in front of you, so it may be an anxiety-provoking situation, or it may simply be, you know, a dinner or a dinner party, could be a lecture, could be your job. But the idea is, in an effort to be completely present, you fully enter in and you do it without judgment and you let go of the self-consciousness. So it's often the self-consciousness, the what-if-ing, the, you know, what happened last time, what's going to happen now, what happened, what's going to happen 5 minutes from now, what are they thinking, that those kinds of sort of mental exercises that we go into actually keep us from fully participating. So they distract us. So the act of participating, and it's a real practice, is being in the moment, being one mindful in the moment and present, and not getting caught up in those judgments. So at times it can be to help you certainly with anxiety. With other times it can be to help you attend to the situation at hand, to the relationship at hand, to the task at hand.
Good. You good with that, Blaze?
I'm pretty good with that. Yeah, no, definitely. I think that's an excellent way of explaining it. I think for me, fully participating as in therapy, the way that I think about it is that is what I am doing in that moment. I am fully in that moment. Nothing exists outside of that. Now, again, it's the same thing as the previous question, which is, yes, you can be fully in that moment, but you can get so caught up in that moment that nothing else exists. So that mindfulness is also about expanding your awareness. But it's just being present. I mean, patients will say in therapy is, I really feel that you're listening. And that's, we talk about validation in DBT, and that you're just fully being attentive to what the person is saying, just being really connected in that moment. So you're fully participating in what's going on. But it doesn't only have to be in therapy, but in each other's lives. It's so easy to be distracted by so much stuff that's going on. So.
Great. Say, Perry, do you want to try and unmute? I've got a couple others, but you want to see if there's someone that would rather talk than write?
Sure. Let me unmute people. And if anybody, if you keep yourself on your own mute, if you don't want to talk, that would be great, so we won't have dogs or background noise. Thanks. Okay, the floor is open.
I heard somebody take a deep breath. Any questions? Okay, let me go ahead and this one here is this has to do with being judgmental or non-judgmental. It's a move toward healthier thoughts, but surely we can't extinguish all judgments. Some may be necessary. Just kind of fill in any blanks the person might have on this. They asked for comment on that.
I'm going to if you ever want a great debate, you should get me and Blaze and I going about the existence of judgments and non-judgments. But I'll let him him tackle this one.
I think the issue is I have noticed in my own life and just how judgment has really, really affected me in ways that I just don't like being. And so judgments are often shortcuts. I mean, it was a bad meal, it was a good meal, that was stupid, I can't believe that person did that and everything. So these sorts of things, they're often trivial. But the problem is that when you don't recognize these things and they are trivialized, then you don't practice non-judgmental thinking. Now, yes, I can be a judgment Nazi, as opposed to say. It's like, there's some, I get, it sounds very like nails on a chalkboard when somebody's being judgmental of somebody else. But I also recognize that me being judgmental about other people being judgmental is me being judgmental. So that, and compassion towards people who are being judgmental is that's the way that they are, and at that moment, and that they can learn to be less judgmental. So the question is not so much about judgment or not judgment. For me, the question is much more about curiosity. Why. Why do we think these thoughts about other people? Why do we say that person is stupid? Why do we say that person is manipulative and all of these things, rather than being curious about who they are? And often we can describe much more carefully what it is that they're doing that we think is stupid. And by slowing ourselves down and doing that, we're practicing a non-judgmental stance. But I understand that there are shortcuts. I mean, words have multiple meanings, you know, and I think that to automatically assume that I know what you mean when you're calling someone stupid or cold-hearted, I may or may not know. So I think it's just better and easier if you just describe to me what they did rather than saying that this is what they did, because there may be a reason for why they did what they did, and maybe we can do better, you know. And if we take a more compassionate view of ourselves and each other's behaviors, I just think that, by and large, I just simply feel happier thinking better of people. And I understand that thinking better can also be a judgment. I'd rather take that perspective rather than a more negative one.
That work for you, Jillian? Sounds like somebody's changing coins. Okay. Now, you still on, Perry?
Yes.
Okay. We'll make one last request. If anyone has a question they'd like to ask, fire away. Thought somebody was getting ready. Okay, what else do I have left here? I'm with another person. When I am with another person, I try to concentrate both my own thoughts and behaviors, plus what the other person may be thinking and doing. To be most effective, where can I best put my focus?
I think that first of all that the practice, you know, you always want to break any practice down into its component parts, and to, you know, so what you want to do is if you're thinking about I think that the idea of thinking what you're thinking and thinking about what somebody else is thinking at the same time is, I don't know that I can do that, but the idea is to sort of break down and stop and just sort of say, okay, I'm noticing judgment to what that other person has done. What could be in their mind that explains their behavior? So if somebody is extremely tired and you're talking to them and they fall asleep, that you would then understand, okay, wait a second, if they're fully asleep, they're fully tired, well, I can understand why they fall asleep. If what they thought that what you were telling them was so boring that they fell asleep, that then that would be a different thing. So what I'm saying is break it down into its component parts. Don't immediately try to get into a position of what's going on in my mind and what's going on in their mind at the same time, because I think that that's a difficult thing to do.
Great. Well, folks, we've done it. We really cannot thank the two of you enough for your sterling series on the skill, or I should pluralize that, the skills of mindfulness. You really made it so user-friendly. Hopefully, you'll be able to join us in the future. Look for a call from Perry sometime, maybe for next fall or next spring. This has been just great. So thank you again. And a final announcement is for everyone to mark your calendars for Sunday, July the 29th. At 8 o'clock Eastern Time for a return of Drs. Charlie Swenson and Kelly Kerner. They're going to wrap up their series called Connecting the Dots. So thank everyone for being on the line. And again, Dr. Aguirre and Dr. Galen, you've been fantastic. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you so much to both of you, and we look forward to seeing your book out in print.
Yeah, well, we want to just, I speak for myself, but I just extend a lot of gratitude for everybody who shared this call-in series with us, for my co-presenter, Dr. Gannon, for NEABPD, and Jim Hall and Perry, who are often held in loving kindness in my own mind, for all the just tremendous and tireless work that you guys put in. And I know that you mentioned it earlier, but it is a fully all-volunteer organization. I've never known either of the two of you to take a penny, and you give so much of yourselves out. And so, yes, anything we can do to support the organization, thank you.
Thank you so much. Everybody have a good July. We look forward to having you back with us at the end of July. And Jillian and Blaise, we hope you'll come back because, as Jim said it so well, you've made mindfulness not as difficult as for those people who don't practice it to maybe think that it's something they could do. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Take care. Good night.